I'm a big fan of Star Trek, The Next Generation. It's an important distinction. Now, I discovered at our men's meeting this week that some of you might not know what that is. So let me give you just a quick, simple explanation. Star Trek, The Next Generation is the greatest science fiction TV show ever made. So that's really the most important thing to get out of this. So, the Next Generation is a show about a group of explorers traveling the galaxy in a massive spaceship. And they explore strange new worlds, seek out new life, and boldly go where no man has gone before. The lead character is the captain of the Starship Enterprise. He's a man of strong principle and integrity. And in one episode, Captain Picard delivers some of the most memorable lines of the entire series. In that particular episode, a group of cadets training to become officers in Starfleet. It's a fictional space force. But these cadets training to become officers are involved in an accident which results in the death of another cadet. And during the investigation which follows, it becomes apparent that the cadets are covering up the truth of what happened. And so Captain Picard calls one of those cadets into his office, chews him out, and demands that the deceitful trainee tells the truth. And in doing so, he speaks these what I think are powerful words. He says the first duty of every Starfleet officer is to the truth, whether it is scientific truth or historical truth or personal truth. It is the guiding principle on which Starfleet is based. And those words resonate because I could say much the same to every Christian. It doesn't apply just in some fictional realm, but we as believers, we have a supreme duty to the truth. We can rightly say truth is the guiding person on whom Christianity is based. So that without the truth, we cannot rightly call ourselves Christians. In Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 through 48 is one of the major sections in the Sermon on the Mount. It's all a single unit, and it's been summarized and can be summarized in a variety of ways. Each summary offers a little bit different perspective, so that we might call this section of the Sermon on the Mount the requirements of righteousness, or what it takes to get to heaven, or the errors of the Pharisees, or the true holiness of heart, or the Christian's obligation to the law. All of those rightly summarize this section. And this section is divided into smaller sections by a series of authoritative statements from Jesus. And each of those statements contains the words, "You have heard it said, but I say to you." And in each of those, Jesus is setting up an addition, not always a contrast, but he is offering up a comparison. And so that, if, for example, the first major section like that, verses 21 through 26, Jesus is not contradicting the law against murder. He's not finding fault with that in any way, but he does find fault with the surface understanding of that law. He pushed their understanding deeper so that they would see that it's not just a command against murder, but helping them understand the viciousness of an angry or hateful heart. And in the second point, verses 27 to 32, Jesus again does not find fault with the law against adultery, but he does find fault with their surface understanding, which failed to recognize lust is adultery of the heart. Now, throughout this section, there are cases where Jesus does contradict what had been heard. And so in that section about adultery, he moves on and he says again, "You've heard it said, but I say," and now he contradicts the traditions of the Pharisees, which misused the Mosaic Law's teaching about divorce. So there Jesus was not finding fault with the law itself, but with the accepted understanding which misapplied the law. So that Jesus condemned the frivolous divorce practiced by many in his day. This frivolous divorce which imagined all you needed was the proper paperwork and your divorce was okay with God. In the third portion of this larger section, it begins in verse 33. And in it, Jesus is not addressing the Mosaic Law, but is addressing the Pharisees' misinterpretation and misapplication of the Law of Moses. He is quoting the Pharisees' interpretation of Leviticus 19, but does not comment on the law itself. So Jesus' comments that we're about to read are focused entirely on the abuse of the law. And so let's read this third section, and then I'm going to attempt to show you how they abused the law. He says in verse 33 of Matthew 5, "Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord.' But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your yes be yes, and your no, no. For whatever is more than these is from the evil one." So to understand the mistreatment of the law that Jesus is correcting, we need to look back at Matthew 23. So turn back to Matthew 23, 16. It's page 1530 in your pew Bibles. But Matthew 23, 16. And Matthew 23 is a record of Jesus' most direct and forceful confrontation of the Pharisees. He rebuked them for their false teaching and the foolishness of their self-righteous law-keeping. And in verse 16, Jesus is denouncing their false teaching about oaths. So let's read verse 16 down to verse 22. Jesus says, "Woe to you, blind guides, who say whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing. But whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, it is nothing. But whoever swears by the gift that is on the altar, that is on it, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and all things on it. He who swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits on it." Now what the Pharisees are doing, and Jesus is quoting their own words in verses 16 and 18, is they were saying that an oath sworn by the temple was not a binding oath. So that you would not be sinning if you broke an oath in which you said, "I swear by the temple that I will do such and such," and then you didn't do it. But if you swore by the gold of the temple, then you would be, that oath would be binding. So if you say, "I swear by the temple I'm telling the truth," you could lie. But if you say, "I swear by the gold on the temple," you have to tell the truth. They also said the same thing about the altar, that an oath sworn on the altar was not a binding oath, but if you swore by the sacrifice that was to be offered on it, then it was binding. I mean, you see what they're doing, right? They're making legal loopholes to make their oaths sound impressive and unbreakable, when really they're about as truthful as a child that is promising you something when he's got all of his fingers and all of his toes crossed. It's not going to happen. They were practicing nothing but legal trickery that was designed to dupe the uneducated and the unsuspecting. And Jesus responded to their conniving by pointing out the foolishness of their logic. They imagined the material goods of the temple were more valuable than the temple and altar. And what Jesus is showing is that their trickery reveals they honored the wealth of the temple and the value of the sacrifices more than they esteemed the God of the temple and the God worshipped at his altar. Jesus is showing, he doesn't directly say it, but I think he's pointing out that the scribes and Pharisees ultimately cared nothing for the true worship of God, for the temple of God, or the altar of God. Rather, they were lovers of money, not lovers of God. All that they cared about was the wealth represented by the gold on the temple and the livestock at the altar. And in response to their idolatrous teachings, Jesus declared what should have been obvious. The value of the temple is not in the building or its treasuries, but in the God who dwells in it. So that Jesus points out to them, the one who swears by the temple of God, the altar of God, or by heaven which is God's, swears by God. Now turn back to Matthew 5:33, because that is exactly the kind of false oath taking that Jesus is confronting in Matthew 5:33. The Pharisees have justified their false oaths by means of a misreading of Leviticus 9:12. So I want you to look at and follow along in Matthew 5:33 while I read Leviticus 9:12. Leviticus 9:12 says, "And you shall not swear by my name falsely, nor shall you profane the name of your God. I am the Lord." So you may see that there are some similarities between those two verses, some important similarities, and there are some differences, and the differences are quite important. So the Pharisees' version of the law about oaths ultimately reveals both their emphasis and the error of their teaching. So Leviticus 19 is forbidding false swearing in God's name. The Pharisees twisted that to mean that all other oath breaking was acceptable. So that according to them, if you did not swear in God's name, then the oath was not binding. So that God did not, since God in that passage in Leviticus and some other passages did not specifically emphasize and state all other oaths are also binding, they found this loophole. So they were perverting the law to suit their own purposes. They were perverting the law in accordance to the things they valued. They valued the wealth of the temple. So they said the oaths made on the gold and the sacrifices were binding. They valued the legalistic keeping of the law. And so they said that the oaths made in careful adherence to the legalistic formula that they had created, those were binding. But no other oaths were necessarily binding. And the Pharisees were liars. They were cheats, frauds, and con men. They used religious-sounding language, legalities, and technicalities to justify their deceit. They were charlatans of the worst sort. And in Matthew 5, Jesus is directly opposing their false teaching and is confronting their folly in a similar way as he did in Matthew 23. So the Pharisees have said oaths that did not invoke God are not binding. Jesus says, first, all oaths invoke God because all things are his. All oaths are binding because every part of creation is God's possession and it's under God's authority. So to those Pharisees who believed you could break an oath made on the hairs of your head, Jesus stressed they're powerless to change the color of their own hair. Now, I didn't plan this morning, but somebody walked in today with recolored hair. So it's just a coincidence. And I have nothing against dyeing your hair. But we recognize that ultimately we have no power over our own hair. Even those maybe that might want to disguise certain evidences of aging, you know that that's just surface. The roots have this pesky habit of revealing their true colors. We can't actually truly change the colors of our hair. It's such a small thing. And we're truly powerless over it. Only God has power over the hairs of your head. And an oath by the hairs of your head is an oath by the God who is greater than your hair and its color. An oath by heaven is an oath by the throne of God. An oath by the earth is an oath by the footstool of God. That's exactly what God is saying in verses 34 and 35. An oath even by Jerusalem. It is an oath by the city of God. So that anything you might swear on is ultimately an oath to God because it is all His. And so He's saying you cannot say that this oath doesn't matter because it wasn't an oath to God. Because it's all God's. But that's actually not, that's kind of the lead up to the solution Jesus gives. Because He's not solving the problem of false oaths by giving instructions on how to make true oaths. The instructions that Jesus gives and the solution Jesus gives to the problems of false swearing is don't swear an oath at all. So when he says there in verse 34, do not swear at all. Now that does raise some questions. So if we're not to swear an oath at all, then why does the Bible say so much about swearing oaths? For example, we read in Numbers 30, verse 2, if a man makes a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by some agreement. So the Old Testament does not directly prohibit oaths, and in some cases it seems to speak favorably of them. So is Jesus now contradicting the Old Testament? Even more, if we are not to swear any oaths at all, then why does God swear oaths? We read in Hebrews 6 that God swore an oath to Abraham. It's exactly the language that He used. He swore an oath. So does God's oath to Abraham contradict Jesus' command in Matthew 5? Now, this is a difficult question to give a full answer to. What I'm going to do this morning is give you the simplified answer that I hope will give you a solid foundation from which you can then build a right answer to specific questions that you may have. In Matthew 5, the simple answer is that Jesus is speaking of oaths made between private parties. Hebrews 6, number 30, and other similar examples are dealing with legal oaths. So that when God swore an oath to Abraham, He was entering into a legal contract with Abraham. He actually followed a careful, recognized legal process in which He was placing Himself under contractual obligation to Abraham to do what He promised. It actually had a greater force than most written contracts would today. The oaths that are addressed in Numbers 30 are primarily oaths to God. And because Israel was governed by God, these oaths can legitimately be compared to a legal oath between a citizen and his king, or between a citizen and the state. All of the oaths addressed in Numbers 30, even the ones not made to God, are legal oaths. They are those, what we might call contracts today. And so Jesus' words here in Matthew 5 are not addressing legal oaths in which one enters into a legal covenant or contractual agreement with God or government, but rather he is speaking about private oath swearing. So we can't understand this statement, do not swear at all, to be a blanket condemnation of all oaths. So I do not believe Jesus is not condemning taking an oath in court, for example, or swearing an oath of office. He's not condemning signing legal contracts. Now, if you have that personal conviction, that's fine. I don't think it's an issue at all that you say, no, I'm not going to sign a contract. I'm not going to swear an oath. And you say, I'm going to just simply say yes, yes, and no, no. I think that's fine. I don't think you're violating scriptures by doing that. But my understanding of this portion of scriptures is not a condemnation of legal oaths, but it's a condemnation of tricky oaths intended to hide truth. It's condemnation of false oaths, swearing to something you have no intention of doing or which you know to be not true. It's a condemnation of unfulfilled oaths. So that if you do make an oath, you keep your word. If you enter into a legal agreement with somebody, that really is our modern equivalent of this oath taking. If you sign a contract with somebody, then you do everything in your power to keep your word, to do what you said you would do. But Jesus here speaking of these private dealings, and whether it be private business dealings, you sell your car to somebody, or just private conversations, we must not be making oaths. So that we must not say, I swear to God, I swear on a stack of Bibles, I swear on my mama's grave, and you know, all the hundreds of ways that sometimes people say those things. And I think even the childish cross my heart and hope to die is a kind of oath that Christians ought to avoid. We need to avoid all of that language that says I'm going to put myself under some extra obligation and some extra consequences if I'm not really telling you the truth. We do not say, I swear. We just simply speak the truth. And the broader culture has devised an elaborate, necessary, and expensive system of protections to guard individuals from fraud or from failure to fulfill promises. And typically, as we know, this involves sort of contract in which the parties involved sign legal documents stating the terms of the agreement, what everybody's going to do, and if one party does not uphold their end of the bargain, then usually the other has some specifically defined rights to seek either fulfillment of the contract or restitution of the broken terms, and so that there is this written legal document that hopefully will stand up in a court to enforce all of the terms. But because man's tendency to deceive and to defraud is seemingly nearly limitless, tens of thousands of attorneys make large sums of money advising clients, examining documents, exploiting loopholes, closing loopholes, and filing suits, and all the other things that certain attorneys seem to do. So much so that at times it seems like the world is just filled with shysters engaged in countless wars of words to try to see who can defraud the most people, or at least make the most money by defrauding the most people. And Jesus prescribes a simple response to that ever-escalating conflict of legalities and technicalities. Be people who speak simply and truthfully. Have a character that is truthful, so that you then forsake jargon for clear statements of fact and intent. So the right response to the problem of deceit is not the creation of ironclad contracts defended by an impenetrable army of lawyers. The right response is to be simple in your truthfulness. Now again, I'm not saying that Christians should never sign contracts or use contracts. Especially as we're dealing with the unsaved world, it seems to be wise to do so. But we should be people who simply speak what we mean, who do not try to get the better of someone else. So we do not use words with double meanings that are intended to hide our true intent. We do not carefully select words to give the impression of complete honesty while actually leaving yourself a loophole to escape your commitments. Do not present an untrue version of events by leaving out certain vital facts. Our words should not be crafty. You should be simple and honest and speak the truth. The truth is anything which agrees with reality, with intent, or with the character of God. So the statement, the earth is flat, is not true because it does not agree with reality. Now, if you disagree with that, we can talk about that later. But even if someone truly and sincerely believes the earth is flat, their statement is still untrue because it does not align with the real world. A promise to pray for someone when you have no real intention of doing so is not true. To speak the truth, you must intend and then follow through with what you say you will do. The statement, God receives all sincere worship, is not true because it does not agree with the character of God. The Bible reveals that God only accepts worship, which is in obedience to His prescribed means for coming to Him. So truth is going to speak those things which are accurate, which we intend to do, and which harmonize with the character of God. So we do not swear, but we speak the truth. And Jesus, verse 37, really is the crucial point in all of this. Speak the truth simply. Jesus says, say no when you mean no, and yes when you mean yes. Do not obscure your meaning with an excess of words. Really, being plain spoken ought to be understood as a Christian virtue. I don't mean being rude and thoughtless is a Christian virtue. I don't mean that we say everything we're always thinking all the time is a Christian virtue. In fact, the book of Proverbs is really clear that only a fool speaks all his mind. So the Bible doesn't tell us to say everything we know all the time. When we speak, we must always speak truthfully. And we must speak that truth as simply stated as possible. It's just, I mean, that really is the gist of what Jesus is saying. Do not multiply words in your truth speaking, but say it as simply and clearly as you can. And Jesus says that anything that goes beyond that does so because of sin. Either the one speaking is trying to assure someone of the certainty of something that's not quite as certain as he's making it sound, or the one listening is suspicious of the speaker's truthfulness. Or maybe the speaker is trying to convince the other he really, really, really intends to do what he says. But all of these attempts of extra assurance come from sin. Now, if you're looking at verse 37, the New King James says, anything that is more than these is from the evil one. That word one is not in the Greek text. And let me give you maybe a more literal reading of it is, but more than this is out of the evil. Now, I know the word the put in front of evil to our mind makes us think of either a specific evil or a specific evil person. Typically in English, that's how we use the in that way. In Greek, that's not always the case. So, let me give you a little bit of a quick Greek lecture here. In the beginning of the verse, what Jesus says, again more literally, is, but the word of yours is to be no, no, yes, yes. Now you say, where'd you get word from? Because I don't see it in my Bible. Our translations actually leave out a couple words. Now they get the sense of it, definitely the sense of what Jesus is saying. But Jesus says, the word of yours. Now that phrase, the word, doesn't just mean one specific word. We understand that Jesus is speaking about our word in general. That what we speak is to be in general and always yes, yes, no, no. Likewise, when we get down to more than these is from the evil, it's not speaking of a specific evil one. It's not speaking of Satan or some other evil person, but rather anything that is more than yes or no comes from evil in general. So that the need to swear oaths in an attempt to convince others of your trustworthiness comes from evil. Either evil within you or evil within those who hear you. And so if we are walking in righteousness, we should be ones who are practicing this simple, not swearing, but just saying no when we mean no, and yes when we mean yes. So this key principle is that the one who is a follower of Jesus, the one who would be righteous, must be truthful, must have a habit of simple truthfulness. So we're not speaking in a way that gives the appearance of truth, but which uses that appearance as a mask to disguise lies. We're not playing word games like the Pharisees did. You must not leave yourself verbal loopholes to hide what you do not want to reveal, while also making it seem like you're revealing the entire truth, or make it seem like you're going to do something when you have no intention of doing it. We must not use omissions or carefully chosen words which are technically accurate but are calculated to leave the listener with the wrong idea. We must never speak in a way that presents an impression contrary to what we know to be true. We ought to speak the truth plainly and simply. And this admittedly it might raise some challenges for you. So I'll give you one quick example. If you ask me if I like something, I'm going to tell you. And I'm going to try to say it politely. But if you ask me if I liked your Brussels sprout casserole with tuna on top, I'm going to say no. It's not what I like eating. And I don't mean that to be hurtful. Hopefully your identity and self-worth is not tied up in Brussels sprout and tuna casseroles. We have counseling for that too. But simply to speak the truth. And there's the aspect of this is a little bit, if you don't really want to hear the truth, don't ask. And I don't mean that, again, unkindly. But simply, and I would take it so far, and I'm using myself as an example, to say I actually do this. Say that as we're talking to people and somebody asks us a question, you know, like that. You know, do you like the terrible meal I just fed you? We don't say, oh yes, it was wonderful. That's a lie. Now we might be more politic and say, I really appreciate your hospitality. You might be able to dodge the question without a direct answer. But if you have to give a direct answer, you have to give a truthful answer. And in simple things like that, all the way through all of our conversations, so that we speak the truth very plainly, very simply. So that what this looks like, I mean, there's a lot of ways that this applies, but we do not go beyond known facts. So I might be able to say, hey, I saw Dennis pulled over on the highway today. There's police officers all around his car. I knew that. I saw that. I didn't see it. But I can say I saw this happen. And those are the facts. I saw Dennis pulled over. But as soon as I go beyond and they were searching his trunk, I think he had drugs in there. And since he's a retired pharmacist, he might have had some legal prescription drugs in there. But I don't know that. I have to stop at the known fact. We must not misrepresent or distort the truth in any way. We cannot slander others. So we cannot speak lies about someone because we dislike them. We must not presume to know the motives of a person. I think this is where it gets challenging, because we like to read into motives. And unless the person has said, I'm doing this and this is why, We cannot read into motives. We have to limit the fact that I don't know what's in their heart and mind. We cannot read into events to draw unwarranted conclusions. We limit our speech to what is known to be true. So we're not passing along speculations or gossip or slander as if they are true. If we are going to repeat a fact, we're certain of the fact before we repeat it. And we must be certain that the way we state our facts is in agreement with the love and grace of God, because we can certainly speak truth maliciously. We can speak it with evil intent. And I can say everything that is literally true, but I'm not making a statement that is in accord with the character of God because I'm making it from a hateful heart. We must be certain our declaration of truth is not coming from a hateful heart or a heart of pride. We must speak the truth and speak it in love. So that Christians, we ought to be the most trustworthy people on the earth. And I remind you that every word that we speak is recorded and weighed by God. Jesus says, every idle word men may speak, they will give account of it in the day of judgment. We must always speak as if we are always under oath, because you will have to answer to God for every word you speak. And I want to throw one thing in. Jesus doesn't specifically mention this, but I think it's worth mentioning that dishonest speech comes from a dishonest heart. So that if you are hiding sin in your heart, you will play games with the truth. You will not be honest because you have a deceitful heart. Lies will come out of your mouth. And so the solution to this is first righteousness and truthfulness in your heart. In Jesus' words, very, very quickly, I want to mention that they are repeated twice in the New Testament. 2 Corinthians, Paul makes truthfulness a gospel issue. He is confronting some attacks against himself, but he says that his words were yes and no. Because in Jesus, all of the promises of God are yes and truly. Because Jesus himself and his message is true. Therefore, if a follower of Jesus and a proclaimer of the message of Jesus is not speaking the truth, then his words, his deceit is going to undermine the gospel message. The other place where this passage is repeated is in James chapter 5. The letter from James was written by the brother of Jesus, not the apostle, but the brother of Jesus and pastor of the church in Jerusalem. And he gets to the end of the letter and he says to them, but above all, my brethren. Now, if you're familiar with the book of James, James contains some incredible, important statements. Do not be hearers of the words, but doers only. Do not be hearers only, but doers as well. He says faith without works is dead. He speaks of the importance of taming the tongue. There are quite a few monumental statements in the book of James, but at the end of the book of James, he says above all, everything else I've already said, do not swear either by heaven nor by earth or with any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no, no. Lest you fall into judgment. James is saying the supreme importance of truthfulness for the Christian. We go to the book of James. It is immensely profitable and instructive as an understanding what it means to be a Christian. And James says, above all of those things, you must speak the truth clearly and simply. And truth must be non-negotiable for us, because truth is the character of our God. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. In Titus 1, it says, God who cannot lie. Numbers 23 says, God is not a man that he should lie. 1 Samuel 15 says of God, the strength of Israel will not lie. Hebrews 6 says it is impossible for God to lie. God does not lie. God does not fail to keep His promises. Speaking the truth is necessary for the Christian because it is the character of our God, the character that we are commanded to imitate. Do you know where lies come from? Satan. In John 8, verse 44, Jesus says of the devil, when he speaks of a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. Satan is the father of lies, even the little white lies. And when we deceive, we are acting like the devil. As a result, the first duty of every Christian is to the truth, whether it's biblical truth or historical truth or personal truth. It is the guiding principle on which the Christian life is based. If you cannot tell the truth, then you have no right to call yourself a Christian. It's that significant. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says his followers will speak the truth. You must. No matter how costly, no matter how painful it may be to yourself, you must speak nothing but truth because our God and Savior is true and the truth. We must be people of the truth.